The Jason Rant Show.
Jason Rant hosts a radio show in Seattle, and he has, as always, the details for us exclusively.
Jason Rant, our Seattle guy, is with us now.
Jason Rant, always great to have you in focus. Thank you.
Hey, Jason, I think you're all right, and thanks for being on the show.
An update on what's happening in your Pacific Northwest.
President Trump goes after Kayleigh McEnany. It is not going so well for him. Conservatives are speaking out, and I think they're right to. Senator Marsha Blackburn stops by to get into the debt ceiling. Plus, we introduce you to another candidate out of the city of Bellevue who hopes to become a conservative on the council. She'll make the case this hour on The Jason Rant Show. So, let's dive in.
The monologue.
Oh, hey, look at that. It only took another escape, this time of seven dangerous juveniles, including one who was found guilty of murder. It took another escape for the media to pay closer attention and hopefully the state to pay closer attention to what's been going on at Echo Glen, where so many staff members have been saying over and over and over again that they're concerned about their safety. They're deeply concerned about their safety. And they feel like they've been completely ignored. And now, according to King 5, the union that represents the staff there, they're saying, hey, managers, you need to do something now. The Washington Federation of State Employees are saying, we are dealing with dangerous kids who are literally hurting us, sending us to the hospital. And you guys don't seem to care all that much about our safety. You had over the weekend a staff member who was beat before they stole that staff member's car and then escaped. She was locked in a cell. She's dealing with an emotional trauma beyond just the physical trauma. And the folks there are saying enough is enough. We can't deal with this anymore. Mike Yastrzemski is the president of the Washington Federation of State Employees. And he tells King 5 that this has been going on for way, way, way too long.
Sad part about this is it takes these extreme events to get attention.
Mm-hmm.
But the danger was there last week before these kids escaped.
Well, the danger has been there for years. I've spoken to a number of staff members and people close to staff members over the course of the last several years. Not everyone still works in DCYF, but they've been, and that's the Department of Children, Youth, and Family. They have been complaining for a long time. And in a lot of ways, one of the leading issues behind this is staffing, which was made worse during the pandemic, made worse after staff members just across the state were fired for not being vaccinated.
The biggest issue really comes down to having appropriate staffing levels and appropriately trained staff.
So what all will happen next? What does this mean? Because we obviously have a big news story that has caught some media attention, but that's going to go away in a few days, right? Maybe we get an update once we get word on what the official charges will be against some of the teenagers who are very clearly dangerous. And yeah, sure, we'll have another follow-up maybe on that'll spur a follow-up on some of the concerns from the staff. But what exactly is going to be done? Because the last time that there was a major breach of security at a facility that doesn't even have a fence around it, we got this list of claims that were of different programs that would be implemented or different strategies that would be implemented to prevent this from happening in the first place. And clearly that was unsuccessful. So right now we can tell you that they say that they're setting up an alert system that will allow the Snoqualmie police chief or captain to just basically initiate a message to the county that gets, and by the county, I mean the residents who live there, saying that there's been a breach. Here's a notification of exactly what happened. It would be, for the most part, specifically to the Snoqualmie neighborhood of the county. We're talking about Eagle Point, Astor Creek, Deer Park. Those are the ones that are directly around the Echo Glen Children's Center. I just don't know if that addresses the main point, which is the safety of the staff who care deeply about helping these kids. That's why they get into this particular part of social work. And we're failing them. We're failing them. And so it's not about the lip service that will be paid in the next week or so. It's about what's going to happen a month from now when I go back to DCYF and I say, what have you guys done to address this issue? What have you guys actually done? And I guess we'll have to judge them then. Now this.
The interview.
Housing First as a model to go after homelessness does not work. And yet still, that claim persists. There is a fantastic article in The Federalist by the co-founder of the Discovery Institute, Bruce Chapman. And he joins me now. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jason.
It drives me nuts that people think Housing First works. And oftentimes they'll point to Salt Lake City, where it in fact did not work. Homelessness got worse after they decided to approach the problem with the Housing First model. Why do you think that myth persists?
Well, there are built-in lobbies for making it the policy of the federal government. And what this article tried to do was say that the federal government, not just local and state government, is responsible for this emphasis on Housing First. Jason, you deserve a lot of credit going back several years for pointing out to your listeners, and I was one of them, that the people who were running the programs treated housing vouchers as inputs and considered them as a success. All they were is inputs, not outputs. Mm-hmm. They didn't show the success of people actually getting off of the street and into permanent housing and getting better as they would if they'd gotten over an addiction or a mental illness. So failing to deal with the real problems, which are mental illness and drug addiction, is just a recipe for disaster, and that's what we have.
Exactly, and you approach this in your piece. I think you refer to it as Housing Plus, where no one's necessarily opposed to housing as a general concept, but it has to be at least tied to whatever the underlying reason the homeless person is homeless to begin with.
Part of the problem we have is that the federal government doesn't have any advocates for dealing with the real problem. Congress barely has a couple. Andy Barr from Kentucky, who now is a congressman who heads the Committee on Housing. Yep. He understands it, and he's trying to do something about it with this Housing Plus program. All he's trying to do is reuse some of the housing money for mental illness and drug addiction and job training. I think it's a very meager bill, actually. It's not nearly as much as we need, but it's a start. It would put about $3 billion into the hopper for the whole country, but it would be a start. And it would also, for the first time, recognize that it's not just housing.
What does success look like to you as far as a timeline is concerned? Every homeless person is different. They're dealing with similar issues, but every person is different. How would you rate a program a success?
That's a very good question, and I don't have a meter or a method that would try to put a definition out. Each person is different, and a person with schizophrenia is not a person with bipolar, which is not the same as a person who starts out with drug addiction and so on. So each person has to be treated differently. That's why we should reinstitutionalize some of these people at Western State Hospital and elsewhere. And we've been deinstitutionalizing for 50 years, and we're now down to 5% as many hospital beds for psychiatric patients as we had 50, 60 years ago. And which is nonsense. The population is much bigger. Each one of these people deserves discrete, separate, tailored treatment. And I don't know that each person is going to have the same outcome. But for some people, it means just simply getting sober, getting back on their feet. They're probably going to be wards of the state one way or another forever. Other people can go back to work and become productive members of society.
And that should be seen as the goal, but it feels like the goal is now just getting people inside, relying on the subsidized housing, which I know why local nonprofits like the Low Income Housing Institute love that idea, because that gives them job security forever. It feels like there's going to take a significant political move to change the direction. And I don't know if there's enough pressure on politicians to do that.
Part of the problem is that the public doesn't understand the connection between policies at the federal level and the state level and what's going on in front of their eyeballs on the street. They see these terrible situations on the street. They see the crime rate. They see the car prowls. They hear about people's houses being invaded, all kinds of things happening around these homeless camps, which were really drug camps for the most part. And they see that. They see the results, but they don't see how it happened. So as a result, they don't actually tell their congressman, get behind changing the law, change the policies. Even the federal people who are supposed to follow this and really don't, you know, they don't have an axe to grind, like Thomas Insel, who is a psychiatrist, the head of the National Institute of Mental Health. He put out a book last year, a very fine book called Healing, and in it he admits that they started out to reform the mental institutions 50 years ago, and they wound up creating a mess of where we are not caring for people with psychiatric needs. By the way, the state of Washington is one of the worst. We have one of the worst records in the country, for particularly for now, for people who are in jail, who are not fit, not competent to stand trial, but they also can't get treatment for their mental illness. This is barely being examined by the state government. But the state government has a role, and they have neglected. Inslee's been a terrible governor on this issue.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can just add this to the long list of issues he's been terrible at. I hope people will check out the piece. It's available over at The Federalist as well as the Discovery Institute. Again, we've been talking with Bruce Chapman. He is the co-founder of the Discovery Institute. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you, Jason.
Now this.
The monologue.
Well, I think President Donald Trump gets a bad rap unnecessarily and in exceptionally petty ways from the media. He doesn't get a total pass when he's the one who's being petty. And he did something yesterday on Truth Social that I've never seen so many conservatives coming together in a unified voice to call this out, because he decided to go after Kayleigh McEnany, his former press secretary, of course, now a Fox News host. And he sent out the message, Kayleigh Milquetoast McEnany, he misspelled Milquetoast, just gave out the wrong poll numbers on Fox News. I am 34 points up on DeSantis, not 25. While 25 is great, it's not 34. She knew the number was corrected upwards by the group that did the poll. The rhinos and globalists can have her. Fox News should only use real stars. That is a shameful attack on someone who's been incredibly loyal to you, Donald Trump. She's been incredibly loyal. And making a mistake on a poll, my God. Seriously, my God, that's what you're going to be upset about? Just correct the poll. Why go after someone who has been incredibly loyal to you and, by the way, has been celebrated by conservatives on the MAGA Republican side, who now all of a sudden are also turning on her? And there was a tweet by Mike Cernovich last night when this was all breaking. And he said, essentially, you have no values if you're willing to just go after Kayleigh McEnany after celebrating her as a tremendous press secretary who took on the media. You were cheering her on. You were sharing her videos. You were encouraging her work. And you've been encouraging her work up until now. But all of a sudden to just turn on her because she made a simple mistake that in the grand scheme of things is not meaningful in the least. You lack principles and values. Brian Kilmeade on Fox News defended her.
He flies off the handle. For example, attacking Kayleigh McEnany is insane. She's one of the best press secretaries ever. Dana Perino, as Ari Fleischer are watching too, just saying she was fantastic. But she's an analyst now. She doesn't work for any campaign.
So many folks have been picking this up that normally defend Donald Trump, including Jenna Ellis, who's the former legal advisor. She's also calling this out. I think it's so petty. What does loyalty mean to President Trump? He expects everyone to be loyal to the point where they don't even make a mistake. And if you demand loyalty to the point where no one is allowed to criticize anything you say or do, then no, you do not deserve that kind of loyalty. Loyalty is earned. And you don't earn it when you offer no ability for someone to, in good faith, speak about a poll that you might be involved in or speak about a policy that you're proposing. I was really disheartened by the attack on Kayleigh McEnany, and it's happening at a time where I think there are a lot of people who are like me, who supported Donald Trump, are thinking about supporting him this time around, but the only thing that's standing in our way is, oh, now Ron DeSantis is running. I really like Ron DeSantis. I really like Tim Scott. And I have to start thinking about who can win in a general election. And I know that most folks on the left and in the media believe that it's Ron DeSantis who can easily win or at least have an easier shot. But I also don't want to just dismiss Donald Trump because I liked his presidency and I liked a lot of his policies, most of his policies. I certainly liked my life more under him than under Joe Biden. But if I'm being forced to choose between Ron DeSantis and Donald Trump, this is the exact kind of behavior that pushes me towards Ron DeSantis.
The interview.
My next guest is going from the former chair of the East Bellevue Community Council. She's coming in as a neighborhood advocate, hoping to help reshape the Bellevue City Council. She's running for a city council seat. Her name is Betsy Hummer, and she joins me now. Betsy, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Jason. I'm honored to be asked to interview on your show.
Absolutely. Well, let's dive right in. What do you think is the biggest issue facing the city of Bellevue?
Public safety is the biggest issue. With the influx of, it's really changed over the last several years. And as I doorbell, me and my team have hit over 10,000 doors, we've reached 10,000 voters over 5,000 doors. And I've talked about 2,000 people, and they're all concerned about the increase in crime.
What specifically about crime? What kind of crime are they experiencing? Because obviously, you know, when you look at a city like Seattle or Tacoma, you're seeing homicides go through the roof. That's not been the case in Bellevue, thank God.
No, it is not. And what we're seeing are property and assault crimes, and they are on the rise. That rampant shoplifting that is throughout our city, from Fred Meyer to Target, even the upscale places like the Bravern, people just walk in and scoop handbags off and race out the door. You know, it frightens people. It makes them wonder what's going on, and it just goes unchecked. And it's not people stealing stuff to help themselves through the day. It's people stealing stuff for profit, and it's that organized retail crime. And it just instills a sense of fear, uncertainty, and people are just uncomfortable.
I think clearly we can point to state policy for the reason why we've got some of these issues, not just in Bellevue, but across the state. Yeah. So from a local level perspective, what would you be able to do as a council member to address that?
I would be able to first make sure that our police are fully funded, they're adequately supplied, that we have a full contingent that of police officers, that patrols are increased around stores. I find that even just an officer walking into a store reduces the crime right there. I think also we need to lobby our state legislators. We always have a legislative agenda and make sure that they restore the powers for the police to do their job to the police. One thing we can have outreach to particular retail stores, if the stores don't report the shoplifting, then the police can't form a targeted task force to address that. I talked to one officer during National Police Week, and he said he goes around to all of the stores in downtown Bellevue, finds out when their greatest shoplifting times are, and makes sure that he is present during that time, because it's just like clockwork. They know the bus schedule, they go in and just take the bus home.
Well, what do you think the crime issues that you're experiencing, how do you think it's going to impact the city's brand as being business friendly?
Oh, right. That's it. People won't come if they don't feel safe. People come to Bellevue because of the safety and the schools. Mm-hmm. And if we don't feel safe in Bellevue, if the public peace is disrupted often enough, people are not going to feel comfortable enough to go shopping, go out to lunch, and regardless of the neighborhood. It doesn't matter if it's Crossroads, Factoria, or downtown. If people don't feel safe, they won't frequent the businesses.
Now, you mentioned schools are a really important part of what's drawing people to the city of Bellevue. Obviously, this last year has been a little bit controversial in closing two schools, questions as to the budget, and you know, whether or not more schools will have to be closed in the coming years. What exactly do you think is the issue, and what can the council do to help supplement what the school board is doing in addressing the issues?
Oh, what the school board is doing. And as you know, the council doesn't have...
They don't have direct oversight.
Actually, we don't have direct oversight, but just being aware and available, I think the whole part of public transparency is key, is making sure that we all understand exactly what's going on and when. And the schools weren't actually closed. They were consolidated. And some programs that are in other schools, much older schools, will probably go into those schools that people thought were going to be closed down. And it's kind of a cyclical thing. But I think that the biggest issue facing all of government is the transparency. Just let us know what's going on and we can adapt to it. That's what people are most concerned about, is change that they're unaware of. And when things happen and they're not prepared for them.
Exactly. So I think that is so important.
Letting people know what's going on when it's going on.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, when you get buy-in early on in a process, even if you don't like the direction a school board or city council is going, the fact that you get brought into the conversation early on to be a part of it and be heard, I think goes a really long way in at least addressing some concerns that could easily be mitigated by simply saying, yeah, you can be a part of the conversation. Betsy Hummer, of course, wants you to be a part of the conversation and to go one step forward and vote for her for Bellevue City Council. Yes. Her website is betsyforbellevue.com. It's all spelled out. Betsy with an I, B-E-T-S-I, forbellevue.com. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you very much, Jason.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.
The Jason Rant Show.
Here to react, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rant.
And the rise of soft on crime laws and policies have made it worse.
Our man in the Pacific Northwest, Jason Rant, is on that.
And you keep on bringing these extraordinary stories from Seattle. It's amazing.
Long form.
Well, when it comes to all the important issues that face this country, there's always a senator who is willing to fight the good fight. Senator Marsha Blackburn from Tennessee joins me now. Welcome back to the show.
It is so good to be with you. Thank you so much.
I love the fact that you're always willing to just go toe-to-toe on certain issues that I think are really, really important, some that don't get enough attention. And one thing that is very top of mind right now is China and TikTok. And you pointed out, we learned just over the last 24 hours that some pretty sensitive financial data is being housed on servers in China, which is something that we were told was not actually happening. Where are the efforts to go after TikTok in a way that respects our U.S. Constitution, but also understands that China is a threat?
Well, and Jason, as you know, I've worked on this issue of reining in big tech for about a decade. And for years, there was no Democrat support on this. They didn't want to offend big tech. And you had a lot of Republicans that were in the same boat. They just didn't want to offend big tech. Now, the tide is turning, and people on a bipartisan basis are saying, let's do this. Senator Blumenthal and I have the Kids Online Safety Act. We have the Open App Market Act. I've also got an online consumer privacy bill. All of these measures are gaining bipartisan support. The good thing is what we have to do is allow individuals to own their data online. I say it is to own their virtual you. And for them to be able to control access to their data in the virtual space the very same way they can in the physical space. And people just can't come in and steal your ideas and steal your information. They can't walk into your house and take your banking records. They can't walk in and take your accounts or your insurance policies. But you get into the virtual space, And it is very difficult to track and to bring forward to indict and prosecute these bad actors. So it is time for guardrails, guidelines, for legislation that will put in place penalties and enforcement and give individuals the ability to protect their data. Now, what we have questioned TikTok on is where do you store this data? Because we know that they are data mining, they are marketing all of this data on our children, and they have very arrogantly said, oh, you know, we are keeping it in the U.S. See, we're working with another American company. But looking at their governance documents for TikTok, which is owned by ByteDance. ByteDance is owned in part by the Chinese Communist Party. It was headquartered in Beijing. And when you read those corporate governance documents, it will tell you that members of the board and the corporation have the right to have access to user data. And this is why we have questioned them. They have repeatedly denied that that information was being shared or stored. And now we found out, yes, indeed, it is.
And none of this comes as a shock to anyone. Everyone was pointing this out. You were a leader in all of that. At the same time, another big issue that is getting a lot more attention is the debt ceiling talks. Where do things stand from Republicans in the Senate?
Yeah, and you know, I think it's important to note right off the top, Republicans do not want there to be a default on the debt. Yeah. This is why the House moved forward and did a great package. We in the Senate were ready to vote yes on that. Senator Schumer made the decision not to allow it on the floor. And it took the president nearly 100 days to decide he was going to negotiate with the Speaker of the House. They got what they felt like they could get out of these negotiations. That is going to be what they put on the floor tonight. I understand they're going to open the floor for this vote about 7 o'clock Eastern time tonight and expect to go to the vote about 8:30, 9 o'clock, and then before 10 o'clock it all should be wrapped. So I've got some problems and concerns with the bill. We'll see what exactly comes out of the House. But the fact that there is not the amount of military funding we need to be preparing for an aggressive China, there is not a way to secure that southern border. There is not anything that allows us to get rid of the 87,000 IRS agents. The caps, the spending caps that are put in place, there is a provision that allows the Office of Management and Budget, the OMB director, to waive the spending caps. And Jason, that was the problem with the Budget Control Act that we had in 2011. We negotiated good things in there, and then along come the Democrats and the Obama administration who said, we don't like that. We're going to waive the caps. And, oh, by the way, you can't tie the hands of future Congresses. No, when it is a law, we are a nation that abides by the rule of law, and you can't waive these caps. So they just continued to waive the caps. And, of course, we know when George Bush left office, our debt was at $10.6 trillion. When Barack Obama left office, our debt was about $21 trillion. Basically, he and his administration doubled the federal debt.
Yeah, and it seems like there's no end in sight.
Right. And if you say, well, we're going to waive the debt ceiling from now to 2025, which is what this bill does, there is no telling what that debt ceiling will end up being on January 1st, 2025.
Finally, let's talk about the FBI director, Christopher Wray. He's scheduled to speak with Republicans about this dispute over a document that is not even classified, but it has to do with Hunter Biden and potential illegal behavior, which seems to be the only reason why he wants to keep this document from getting into the hands of Republicans. There are calls and a move to hold him in contempt of Congress, which I don't think has ever been done with a sitting FBI director. What is the reason why the FBI is giving? I know officially what they're saying, which is giving this information could potentially harm some of their investigations. And I suppose if this was a classified document, I probably would agree with that. That would make sense. So what do you think is really going on here?
I think that they're trying to keep there to be any shadow cast against President Biden, and they're trying to protect Hunter Biden. And so for them, it's just easier to say, hey, we're not going to do that. They think that they can act without impunity. They think that they don't have to answer to Congress. We have seen that. You go back to the Clinton Foundation, the Clinton years. Then you look at the Obama administration and you look at what they did to President Trump. You look at what has transpired in this administration. They think that they are on their own, and there's nothing we can do to rein them in. And, you know, wasn't it Chuck Schumer who said, if you cross the FBI, there are six ways from Sunday they can come get you? So they feel like that they can do that. People are tired of two tiers of justice. And, Jason, what they want to do is see equal justice for all. They want government to work for all the people, not just the elite, not just the powerful, not just the few. They want it to be for all.
Yeah, and look, when you're withholding documents, there seems to be a clear indication that there's something on there you don't want us to see. And we know that this entire Department of Justice, FBI, across the board has been seemingly carrying water for Joe Biden and the Biden administration. So we're looking forward to seeing what's actually out there in that document. We've been talking with Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee. As always, thank you so much for giving us so much time. We really appreciate it.
You got it. Take care. Bye-bye now.
You as well. You're listening to The Jason Rantz Show.
The Jason Rantz Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rantz. Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rantz is in focus now.
Jason Rantz, thank you for your reporting on that.
The quick hit.
So everyone does it, and everyone knows everyone does it. And now that it's about to come to an end, or at least being severely restricted, everyone is complaining. And it feels like it's almost a problem that big tech companies allowed to happen. I am talking about password sharing. Netflix apparently is restricting password sharing. And more folks are complaining about it. More and more folks are saying that this is unfair. I don't like the fact that I have to now pay for a separate account. I've been using my mother's password. It's not fair for me to have to spend even more for a login when it's the same family that's using this account. And there's a piece in the Washington Post, and I think it encapsulates really well the way some people think about these things. They write, every 3 months, Brandy Anderson fills her Jeep with clothes, kitchen supplies, a box fan, and a small TV and relocates to a new city. A traveling emergency room nurse for the past 3 years, Anderson has worked in Brooklyn, Boston, and D.C., and is now based in a remote part of Northern California. But her house, husband, and primary Netflix address are all based thousands of miles away in Midland, Georgia. Anderson is one of many longtime Netflix customers upset about the company's new crackdown on password sharing, which launched in the U.S. this week and would prevent her from streaming on the road. After years of ignoring and even encouraging password sharing, the streaming company is asking anyone using a Netflix login for more than 31 days at a different location to get a separate account or pay $7.99 a month to be added on the main account. Obviously, the situation that she specifically finds herself in is not common. However, the whole idea of what to do when sharing a password, especially in the context, and it's been, although not always, but usually a younger person using their parents' account and they don't live in the same household. It certainly started to be used in a big way when you had kids going off to college and mom and dad at home and maybe a different city or a different state completely, and they would allow their kid to use the Netflix account. So what I love about this whole story, is the reluctance of consumers to admit that the majority of the time they're clearly in the wrong, they're clearly stealing, they know they're stealing, and rather than be grateful for all of the time that they've been able to get away with stealing, they're now instead complaining. I would look at this as a glass half full. You just, for the last several years, decade, you have been sharing that account and not paying for it. And you're not in Brandi Anderson's position. You're not in her position. You're clearly abusing the system, and it's hurt Netflix. They need to make money. We already know that. And so now they're saying, okay, we can't allow you to continue to steal from us anymore. We're going to ask for not even all that much. We're going to ask for an additional $7.99 a month. And you're all complaining, and maybe not you who are listening. But there's so many people who are complaining about this, and you know you're in the wrong. We all have done it. I haven't done it specifically with Netflix, but obviously I've done it in a more general sense. I share passwords or use a shared password when it comes to newspapers online because I'm not paying for an account for a news site that I only use maybe 3 times a month, but someone else has an account and I'm able to use it. What I would do if I were Netflix is maybe just offer, instead of going for 2 accounts, one at $21.99 and the additional one for $7.99, maybe make the account $23 and you can only use it at one time. Meaning if the husband in this case, Brandy's husband, is back home in Midland, Georgia, wherever the heck that is, and he's on Netflix, well then the wife, Brandy, who's in this remote part of Northern California, can't use it at the same time. That you can only be logged on at one point and maybe make it so that you have to log in to only one location or one device and you can only use it then. And then when you want to use it somewhere else, you got to log out because most other companies do something similar. I know with YouTube TV, which I use when I'm on the road, I will get, let's say I'm in DC and I log into YouTube TV and I want to watch there and it notices my IP address and my location is somewhere in Washington, DC. And it says, hey, is this temporary or did you move? Now, part of the reason why they do it is not necessarily for the stealing. They do it for the for what they are allowed to show you on broadcast TV, usually around sports, where some stations are blacked out or you wouldn't get access to, say, you know, Como 4 or Cairo 7 if I'm on in D.C. They would give me that location if I move there. But I say, no, I'm only here for a few days, and then they allow me to access whatever it is I would normally access. The only differences are when you're overseas, because that is a little bit different from a content distribution standpoint. Why not just do something like that? Again, part of me also notes that Netflix created this problem because they knew it was happening this entire time, and they didn't say anything, or to the point that Washington Post made, they kind of almost encouraged it. There was a little bit of a wink and a nod for a long time. Why they allowed that, I guess it was to get more buzz and more users to look at their content. But as things evolve, as their business model evolves and gets more expensive, they obviously can't do that forever. And they obviously think that enough people will say, okay, fine, I'll pay the $7.99 or whatever the amount ends up being, depending on your situation, that it makes up for any potential lost revenue or lost viewership. They're clearly taking that position. I understand it, but they put themselves in this mess. And had they started at the beginning to say, no, we just can't allow it, here's why, we're going to have to crack down on it, and they did it in a meaningful way, you probably would not be at the point where people are so loudly complaining. Because there people are who are loudly complaining, which again, just doesn't make sense to me. You are loudly complaining that you're not allowed to steal anymore. And the people who are complaining the loudest, they know what they're doing is wrong, and they would never be able to defend it or justify it other than to say, well, I don't think it's worth that much money for me to pay. I don't think it's worth $24.99 or $30.99, whatever it is. I don't think it's worth it because the content sucks. Well, then I think you just made an argument to just cancel your Netflix account. I canceled my Netflix account about 2 years ago, and I went without Netflix for about a year and a half. And I did that mostly because there just wasn't any content that I liked or wanted to watch with any sort of consistency. Now, that has since changed. I think their content is a lot better. And so I resubscribed. Now I no longer get Hulu. Hulu doesn't have any content that I'm interested in. There's nothing unique there that I want. So I just don't pay for it. Peacock is a service that I was thinking about getting for EPL. But then I realized, well, I'm not going to watch that much soccer. I'll watch what's on NBC Sports, and I get that from YouTube TV, so I canceled my Hulu, or my Peacock, excuse me. So we make these decisions all the time. It's just so odd that people want to completely pretend that they're not doing something wrong. And so now they say their rules are Netflix says an account can only be used by members of one physical household sharing one internet connection. If you want to add additional members to log on from elsewhere, you have to pay an additional $7.99 a month. They say the restrictions appear to only apply to televisions and not mobile devices for now. I imagine that's going to change. So what they're basically saying is you can still do this on your iPhone or your Android or your iPad or whatever. I guarantee you that's going to change. It says you can still travel without issues for up to a month. People will need to connect at the primary location once every 31 days to avoid being logged out of the other account. It doesn't matter what tier you pay for your reasons for being away from the primary address. The company does not have any expectation or exceptions for the most unusual cases like deployed members of the military. And they say in this Washington Post piece that Netflix is mostly using IP addresses to determine where people are logging in from, but it also uses device IDs and account activity. It infers which location is your home base, but you can manually set your household location from Netflix on a TV by going into their account settings. So, you know, they're not penalizing you for sharing, right? They're not like going to police this in any way. And when they find out, those of you who have been stealing, well, you owe us back fees for the last decade that you've been stealing. So just be grateful. And again, this is hard for me to say. It is hard for me to say. I'm usually not the person who looks at a glass half full like this and say, be grateful. But, hey, I have to pay. You should pay, too. 1-800-465-8770. We're going to have an update on the debt ceiling debate and vote at the top of the hour with Fox News. You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.